I've had a few people that traveled with me, and they couldn't quite understand what made me tick. Now, it's one thing to be saved. There are a lot of people that are saved, and they're going to make it to heaven. But, you know, they're really not involved in what God is doing. And for a number of years, I have been probably more totally involved, often than physically I should. One of my very best friends really jumped on me, the wife of one of my best friends, really jumped on me some time ago and just scolded me. Said I was going to widow my wife and really thought she was doing me and God a favor. And I tried to be real gracious to her, and I said, well, I have done more living already than most people do when they live to be 90 or 100 years of age. And if I died right now, I'd be way ahead of the game of life. God has been good to me. He has kept his word and given me abundant life. I enjoy living even through sickness and the days of adversity. And I can sometimes weep for people that seem to have so much of this life's goods. They have so very, very much of material things. And yet they live on such a meager scale. When it comes to real, true living that counts, they are small people. Thank you, Lee. They are small people that are saved. But it seemed like they just cut themselves out of nearly everything that God intended them to have. Jesus said, he that seeketh to save his life shall lose it. And he that seeketh to lose his life for my sake and the gospel, the same shall save it. What shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? Whosoever therefore shall be ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him also shall the Son of Man be ashamed when he cometh in the power of the Father with his holy angels. And if you try to guard your life and protect your life and save your life all for yourself, you'll live a life miserable and wretched. But if you learn to give of yourself, to give freely of your time, your personality, your strength and talents, be they large or small, God will bless you. And in doing so, you will save your life. The symbol of the cross is a symbol of death. We polish it, polished wood and polished metal. We use it as a symbol of jewelry about the neck or on earrings. We put it on our hymnals and the edge of our pews because the cross is very dear to us. The very heart, blood, and heartbeat of Christ and Christianity. But when he said, whosoever will be my disciple, let him deny himself daily. Take up the cross. He said, take up his cross and follow me. Jesus did not say, let him take up my cross. For there's a cross, the songwriter said, for every man to bear. That's his cross. And when you really get involved in Christian service, the type which is needed to take this city for God, you first take up a cross, your cross. And when you do that, you must secondly do something that no man likes to do. You climb your Calvary, and you die on that cross. And you die to all your daydreams and all your inner joys, all your own ambitions. You die to your own ego and you die to your own pride. And when there is no more life to give, you've given it all to Jesus, you'll find that you're more alive than ever before. That something has been reborn within your bosom like a holy resurrection. And even in the throes of death, it was an exciting thing. when you get to the mission field, where it's rough and tough, you find what Paul was talking about, when to be used of God, you have to learn to die. It's the kind of death you have to do every day. And when you're in the ministry, you learn this. This 16th chapter has to do with stewardship and ownership. And he said also unto his disciples, there was a certain rich man. In the Greek, this is Plutus, from which we get the word plutocrat. It was actually the Greek god of money. Money was his god. Money controlled him. It was of this kind of a person that the communists thought the whole world was made of when they talked about economic determination. And the principle of economic determination is a true principle for those that aren't consecrated to Christ. The money factor determines what most people do or don't do. The world is filled with people that fly overseas just to commit adultery or to gamble, to live a wild life and fly home if they could afford it. A lot of people do sinning they aren't doing now if they could afford it. A lot of people live in a different kind of house if they could afford it. But economic determinism is not the controlling factor. Not how much money is in it for me, but when you sell out to Christ, what does the Master want? What is his desire? Certainly he's not broke. He's using gold for asphalt. Jesus, talking of this situation, said, and he said unto his disciples, there was a certain rich man which had a steward, and the same was accused unto him that he had wasted his goods. I have a shelf of books on stewardship at home I've collected over the years. Good books. And in these books, none of them have the proper definitive of stewardship. The whole semantics is not correct. For they talk about tithes and offerings and things like this. And church finances, the responsibility of giving. But they don't get the setting quite right. For in the Bible days, they had very few middle-class people, just extreme rich and poor. They tell me it's a nuisance to be rich. You don't know who your real friends are. You have to worry about the stock market and a lot of things that us common folks don't really fuss about too much. But so the rich man would hire a steward. This steward had to be a trusted man. That's why Jesus said later, in stewardship, it is required above all that a man be found faithful. For this is the way it would work. The master would give the steward power of attorney over all of his matters of estate. So then the rich man could cruise on the Mediterranean, go for a 2-year world trip, see foreign places. During the chilly winters, go to a warmer climate. And then come back, and all of this time, the steward had been running the ranch or whatever it was and making money, buying and selling, as though he was the owner. Now, you didn't get paid a lot of money for stewardship, but the job benefits were terrific. See, the steward got to live in the rich man's house. He rode in the rich man's chariot, did a rich man's business, ate a rich man's food at a rich man's table, carried a rich man's signet, as it were, a rich man's checkbook and a rich man's bank account. When he sold a rich man's commodity, and when he bought like a rich man. It's very difficult to tell that he was not a rich man. But from time to time, the rich man would come back to take inventory. Now, the biggest danger, you see, was that he would forget who the owner was and become prodigal and stop working and start enjoying. And the next time the rich man came back, he would be fired. In those days, if you didn't pay your bills, they would sell you into slavery. And then the price of your body would be given to the one to whom you owed the money. Well, both were losers. You know, if we tried doing that in America, it'd probably revolutionize our financial scene, wouldn't it? So, as the rich man returned in this case, and this is not a parable because as several other stories in Luke that are often called parables, he says there was a certain rich man. So Jesus was telling a story of which he was knowledgeable and using a true story as a parabolic illustration. And the rumor reached the rich man that his steward had wasted his goods. The rumor was true. And the rich man came in and he said, "Give account of thy stewardship, for thou mayest no longer be steward. Give an accounting of the books, balance the books, wrap up the shop, thou mayest no longer be steward." Now that's old English for "you're fired." Now the steward thought, "What shall I do? I cannot dig. To beg, I am ashamed." Now he was not accustomed to hard labor. He had lived like a rich man for so long. And living that grand style, knowing all the businessmen, he'd just beyond below his dignity to be a beggar. So he thought within himself, "What shall I do? For my Lord taketh away the stewardship." And being a clever and wise man, he wouldn't be a steward. By the way, can you imagine anyone you would trust with as a steward of your property? Can you think of anyone you would trust far enough? You'd trust them with your title to your house and title to your car and your credit cards and your checkbook and everything you had? Most of you won't even trust your wife that far. So that kind of helps you see the situation. This steward said, "I know what I'll do. My Lord has a lot of bad debts out." He called in one, and this poor guy is about to be sold into slavery, and said, "How much do you owe my Lord?" He said, "Well, it's about 3 years' wages in wheat. And I about got the slave noose on my neck." Well, he said, "I am just kind of fixing to change employment, and we've done a lot of business together, and I'll tell you what I'll do, old friend. You know, if you could come up with 50% of that, I'd give you a receipt paid in full." Well, to get out of the chains of slavery, he would go and borrow everything and scrape up everything and pay off the debt, you see. And when you're in business and you collect a bad debt, it's like money falling from the sky. Somebody owes you $10,000 and they don't pay it, you write it off the books, and 10 years later they get a seizure of conscience or get religion and pay it. Well, that's a happy day at your house. When you get $10,000 you thought was gone. So the owner would be happy. That, you know, that's a good thing to do in this world, is make as many people happy as you can. Do a little damage. So he called the next one in. "How much do you owe?" "Oh, about 3 years' wages in oil." Same thing. And the Lord commended the unjust steward. And Jesus also commended him. The master didn't say, "Oh, well, I have changed my mind." But you see, now, when he was fired, you were destitute in those days. Why would he ever get a job as a steward again? What's your job recommendation? Why did you leave your last place of employment? He was through as a steward by all ordinary terms. But you see, now he's coming down the road to hungry. And he knocks on one of these debtors' doors. Well, what can he do but give him a bed and a beefsteak? You know, after all, he's the fellow that kept him out of the chains of slavery. And so he was looking to the future. And Jesus himself said, in commenting on this, "For the children of this world are wiser in their generation than the children of light." Which means, by interpretation, that if Albertson's food store down here did business, like most churches in this city, they would have been out of business a long, long time ago. And the application here is not with Albertsons, but it is with you in your service to God. He's talking about your stewardship. You see, according to the philosophy of Jesus that he covers from chapter 10 through to chapter 21 of Luke, stewardship is not something you volunteer for. It is not something you hear a sermon about and you scratch your head and you say, I think that preacher's right. I ought to become a steward. And emotionally moved, you come down and consecrate your life at the altar and say, I am going to qualify. I volunteer for stewardship. That is not the case. You are born into stewardship. It is optional whether you become a Christian or not. When you come into the kingdom, however, a lot of options stop. Now, you don't even need to get into the kingdom to be a steward. You see, most of Christendom operates on an ownership concept. This is my car, this is my house. These are my savings, these are my fields, these are my acquisitions. And this is not true. You are only a steward by Bible semantics. You came into this world as naked as a jaybird, and you brought nothing with you. And the Bible says you go out the same way. You arrive broke, and you depart the same way. And the only thing you have here, you know, it goes through your hands, you are stewards. The old Methodist hymnal said, "This is my Father's world." And that is true. He owned the cattle on the thousand hills. He owns the hills. He owned the silver and gold under the hills. Now, whether you're saint or sinner, you are a steward. And you're in this world for a little while. And this is what Jesus says in this one verse that is very hard for most people to understand. Verse 9 says, I say unto you, make friends with the mammon of unrighteousness, or the Syrian god of money, or the money qualities of this world, that when you fail, they will receive you into everlasting habitations. You have to look at that verse 2 or 3 times before you get the meaning of it. What are everlasting habitations? What's a habitation? Somebody speak out. What is a habitation? Oh, a dwelling place. Well, then what's an everlasting habitation? Well, an eternal one, all right. Now, how many eternal habitations are there? 2. I don't think the Lord was recommending one of them. All right, now, what do you have to do to get into either one of them, of the two? What has to happen? You depart from this world. All right. You have to die. Right? Unless there's an exception to the rule, like Enoch. But basically, most of you are going to die. Well, that's how you'll get there unless the Lord comes first. All right. So this failure, that when you fail, when the angel of death touches you once upon the heart and once upon the lung, and your heart fails, your lungs fail, you fail, and you drift out of this world, separated from body and soul, needing an eternal home until resurrection morning when you get a body back. And then, for all eternity after that, they will receive you in their everlasting habitations. Why, the Lord knows there's a lot of people in this city we couldn't trust in heaven. We couldn't turn them loose in heaven for 5 minutes. First thing they'd do is grab a hammer and a chisel. Go to work on the asphalt. They'd be pecking the diamonds out of the walls. Heaven's engineered for honest people. Won't that be something that just enough to bless me all to pieces to think of all the millions of people going to be in heaven? And you can trust him with anything or everything. And everybody there want to tell the truth. And you won't need a policeman or a CIA an FBI? Oh, heaven's a great place. I better get off from heaven or I'll just wind up preaching on heaven and forget everything else. It's one of my favorite subjects. When you fail, they'll receive you in everlasting habitation. Well, that seems strange, for he says, Syrian god of money, you know, make to yourself friends of the Syrian god of money. Well, then do you mean to tell me that you can buy your way into heaven? Some of you shaking your head. Well, you know, one man, great theologian, said this is the most difficult verse in the whole Bible. I'm famous for picking those. And I preached on this one time, and preached on about an hour. And one of the more mature men in the church said, I haven't the slightest idea what Brother Crowder was getting at. He wanted the pastor to explain it to him. Pastor said, you'll have to ask Brother Crowder, because I'm not sure myself. Well, I'd like to make it so simple, the little child or fool need not miss the way. You know, if you read it a few times, some of you don't know the verse well enough to see the problem. But what Jesus said is to make to yourself, make friends with money. In order that, when you die, they'll receive you in the everlasting habitation. And not one of you thinks you can buy your way into heaven. But you see, often in logic, you use inverted logic to clear up a difficult thing to handle. All you have to do is invert it. And immediately it is simple. How many of you think that there are some people that will not make it to heaven because of the abuse of money? How many think that some people really lose their soul over money? All you see then, the way you use money is a factor in when you get to heaven or not. And when you invert it, it's so simple. In other words, in your use of money, be sure that you don't sell your soul. And don't sell Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. And be sure you have a holy consecration down to the marrow of your bones. And if you're going to lay your life upon the altar, a living sacrifice, then be sure that you get your marrow, your teeth, your bones, and everything there is on the altar. Because God will not accept a 97% deal. Or you give him 97% and keep 3 for your own personal stinking ego. Either you're for him or against me, either I come, your life before father, mother, sister, brother, or you have no part with me in the kingdom of heaven. And I tremble at the judgment day for the multitudes that think that they can put God first when they feel like it. God's day first when they feel like it. God's house first when they feel like it. God's tithe first when they feel like it. And when they don't feel like it, they have total free option to do completely the opposite. Never forget, ladies and gentlemen, that you will come down that long, long, haunting, lonely aisle of the judgment, and you'll stand before him, and the book will be open, and every carpet that ever crossed your hand will be recorded in the accounting books of the sky, and you'll give account for the things whispered in closets. Matthew chapter 12. And he will judge you for the thoughts and intents of the heart. And when I read these scriptures, I want to get alone and weep before God and cry again, oh God, make me as clean and make me as right as the blood of Jesus Christ can make a man. And I don't care how crazy and tangled and snarled and turbulent the issues of life may be, right in the midst of the storm, whether it be a social storm, whatever it may be, personality conflicts and people being wrong, by the grace of God somehow, I want to be right. And I want to stay right. And if I get wrong, I want to get right again just as soon as I possibly can. Oh, how I wish there were more people that wanted to be right in this world. Well, it's getting a little solemn out there, but I'll admit it's not Jubilee preaching. And maybe in the silence, some of this will settle through in your soul. Tithing is the minimal regulatory law. That keeps you out of the damnation zone. My wife and I quit the tithing principle years ago. I mean, we tithe. Don't misunderstand me. That's the first thing that comes out of every bit of money we get is our tithe. But that's just, I mean, anything less than that, according to Malachi, is damnation. And tithing is the only moral principle that you can experiment with. Try me and see me and prove. If I won't bless you until your barns and silos won't contain the blessing. Why? Some of you didn't even know you had barns and silos. That's what kind of steward you've been, huh? He said, you just try it. So he gives you permission not to tithe. How many can hear me? If you can, turn your hearing aid up. Put new batteries in it. You see, because you need to hear this. And I go on record, and this is going on tape too. I give you, on the basis of Malachi, permission to experiment and not tithe. With faith in God. And you know what the Bible says? This is what he says, try me and prove me and see. There's no other moral code in the Bible you can experiment. Where does the Bible say you gentlemen commit adultery for 6 months? And then the next 6 months, be true to your wife. And the next 6 months, commit adultery. And whatever works out the best. You won't have a wife by the time you get through that experiment. Try telling the truth for 6 months. And then lie for 6 months. And then see whatever works. You know, tithing is the only principle because God said, see, and when you tithe, then I'll bless you. And if you don't believe that, you know, you're questioning the whole principle of God's bountiful provision. I just love to preach on money. Lord, let me preach on it all the time because some people just squirm all the time you preach on, you know. You just wonder which one's going to have a nervous breakdown for it. But my wife and I switched over a long time ago to see how much we could give, not how much we can get. Until the last couple of years, we gave 50% of everything we took in. You know, after the expenses were paid, 50% to missions. Sometimes we've taken food off our table and clothes off our daughter's back. But we've never gone hungry, and my daughters have never gone naked. And somehow it's worked. And I've had the philosophy, you know, even if I have the money and need a car, don't buy a car. Pray about it. Maybe the old tavern keeper will give you a car, and you can give your money to missions. And it's worked pretty good for me over the years. Just the other day, just the day before I was coming, I was out trying to get this camper out of a farmer's shed, and there's a 70 Chrysler sitting out there, and I said, I didn't know you had that car. Well, he said, I don't need it. He said, would you like to have the car? Plymouth or Chrysler one, I don't even know what it is, I haven't got it yet. He said, that's got new radios on it. I said, I'll tell you what I'll do, preacher, I'll give you that car. Well, I was just looking for one to buy, because I had about $200,000 on my last. Well, I don't know what it's worth, but it's a good car. That's better than monthly payments. I can see you're not nearly as happy about it as I am. That was car number 10. I am really getting judged. The Lord didn't give me Cadillac this time. Last number had been Cadillacs. But I'm getting demoted down to a Plymouth or something. I might come in on a Honda next time, but if the Lord... Whatever the Lord sends in. I'll tell you, I'll pedal a bicycle if I need to preach the gospel. But it has worked, what I'm saying. I was at a mission convention, and I felt I ought to give $500. The need was genuine and great, and they'd asked me to come and plead the cause. And Sunday morning, I was driving that Sunday afternoon to preach another place. And I said, well, I'm going to pledge $500. I thought my wife was going to pass out, but my wife is with me. Don't misunderstand. She'll push me if I don't. Called her the other day, and this was several months ago, and we were having a little financial struggle, and we have some other problems. And she said, you know what I think is wrong? And I was really worried. I'd just been given to the disaster point. And I said, well, what do you think's wrong, Nellie Blue? And she said, I think what's really wrong is I think we need to increase our missionary gift. I just broke down a ball on the phone. I'll tell you, that's a great wife. Some of you fellas couldn't live like I live. Your wife would have left you a long time ago. That busted me up. We need to increase our missionary giving. God has been really so good to us. But anyway, my wife...